Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
You've heard of people with nicknames like the Wolf of Wall Street or Tony the Big Tuna Accardo, but you've probably never heard of the Donald Trump of the art world. If you have, you'll know who my guest is today. It's Stefan Simkowitz. I've known Stefan for almost 5 years and have watched his career boom in that time, not from tech, investing, or real estate, but from finding undiscovered artists, making them famous, and himself rich at the same time. He's received a lot of praise for this and a fair bit of criticism, too. As Art Review noted about Stefan, if the art world needed its Howard Stern, its Ari Gold, its Donald Trump, it got Simcoe, a brash, publicity-hungry, yet highly intelligent collector, advisor, dealer. Personally, when I look at who gives him the criticism, the snooty art critics of old, it appears Stefan is doing something right. But no matter what you think of him, you'll agree that he's a fascinating person to have a conversation with, and is never afraid of calling things exactly how he sees them. I'd like to welcome Stefan to my show. So, thanks for joining us today, Stefan. This is where you say my pleasure.
My pleasure. it's very passive. It's very sort of weird that I'm looking at you.
That you're looking at me, and also
the microphone.
Is big. So let's just jump right in. And you have been called.
I feel like we're on a date. Like I should look at you in the eyes or something.
Let's pretend we're at a date and we're sitting at a bar.
Okay, fine.
We're at a diner.
Okay.
Going to get ice cream.
I can't look at you. I'm romantically involved, and we've only been doing this for 60 seconds.
Okay, so let's start where I first read something about you, and that was when you were being called the Donald Trump of the art world.
Oh, awful.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
You know, it's interesting. I woke up one morning and I read this drivel, and it was written by this guy, Christian Viveros Fawn or something. I didn't know who he was.
Where was it?
It was in ArtNet or Art News, and I read it, and it was so savagely sort of brutal and sort of mean-spirited that I actually felt like Donald Trump for a minute and was like, fake news. This is terrible. And it's sort of, you know, it was just awful clickbait, especially for someone like me who really is not supportive and has never been of that presidency or the individual. It was like reading fiction, basically.
So what was the argument that said that you were the Donald Trump of the art world, and why? I mean, you've had a lot written about you over the years.
I don't think there was an argument. I think it was like a headline. I think it was like, he's a bully and he does this. And I think it was. I've read so many things about myself that, you know, one of the things people say to me when they meet me is they're like, you're nothing like what we thought you were from reading about you.
So let's just set this up for the listener who hasn't read a lot about Stefan Simkowitz. What are some of the negatives that people say?
Oh, everything.
Give us a few.
I mean, you name it, I got it. Satan, evil.
Why?
Opportunist. You know, I buy art. I do many things, but one of the things I do very well is I buy art very early from young artists and support them. And oftentimes those artists go on to become very successful in often short periods of time, and the value of the work that I buy or have bought has appreciated pretty substantially. And people view that as being opportunistic. I view it as being helpful, as having a good eye of being able to see things very early when other people are not interested in buying. It was very funny, and in I have this sort of joke that in Berlin, where there are a lot of young artists, I'm considered to be an opportunist, And in Africa, where I'm, where I've become quite active, I can now be considered a colonialist. So as I move my geographic location.
And what do you consider in America, a businessman?
In America, who knows? In America, I'm labeled as what, this, that. I you know, cultural entrepreneur.
So one of the things that I don't understand about the art world, and my wife is an artist, and I actually studied art in school before I became a journalist, is what is considered art. So I went to your office, and this will, I'm sure, come back to the Donald Trump of the art world comment, but I visited your office, and you have lots of amazing stuff up, but then there's also some things that I don't really understand. There was actually the thing that stood out to me, there was a bag of fake oranges, I believe, on the table, and then another bag of fake oranges on a chair, and I said, what are those? And you said, it's just a bag of fake oranges, but that is art, right?
I mean, yeah, I think it's art. It's created by a young guy in Ohio named Tyler Macko. And, you know, he makes sculpture, he makes painting, and I think it's just playing around with this idea of what is a bag of oranges. And when you turn a full bag of oranges into, like, 100 sculptures of oranges cut in half, it's kind of funny in a way. It's like, so, it's so sort of...
So what does that sell for? What does a bag of oranges sell for as art?
I've never sold one before. It's not, they're not that easy to sell, but I like them, and I like this idea of just having this like bag of oranges that's actually like this sculpture of 100 oranges lying on the floor or lying on a very expensive Nakashima table. I think there's this... So, you know, artists play with different ideas, and I think Tyler, who lives in Dayton, Ohio, where there really are very few artists, is sort of playing with these ideas of like the everyday object as an object of art. And by the way, I urge all of you, since you're listening, if you're listening, that is, to go to my website, simcoesclub.com, and you can look at pictures of the artists and see the list of artists. You can actually see what we're talking about here by Googling and getting a bit of visual imagery in the background while you listen to
that. A lot of people pay a lot of money to advertise on this podcast. You just got a free URL check there. Okay, so let's look at this a little further. So you go and you find artists.
Simcoesclub.com. I'm kidding.
You go and you find artists that have never been discovered. You represent a kid who was homeless and lived out of his car and is a painter and now is painting self.
I mean, artists who haven't been discovered, artists who have shown a lot. You know, I work with a South African artist named Cameron Platter, who I think is one of the most brilliant artists working on the continent. He's shown a lot. He's in galleries, he's in museums, he's in the Museum of Modern Art. But his career hasn't really been able to... He hasn't penetrated sort of to be known by everyone for a number of reasons. So, yeah, I'm looking for artists who are very talented, either overlooked, underappreciated, or artists who are just beginning. But
my question is how do you define what is art and what is a good artist? Because, you know, we were just walking through my house and I showed you a painting that my 2-year-old did, which I think is beautiful, and you could probably put that in the MoMA and put Dean Kuntz's name under it, and no one would know the difference. And so, when I think about the bag of oranges and some of the work that you represent and others and so on, I have a hard time kind of understanding how this is all defined and how something can sell for millions of dollars that looks like my 2-year-old did it.
Well, not everything sells for millions of dollars. You know, there's this extremity of it sells for something sell for $5,000, $3,000, $10,000, $20,000, $50,000. So this extreme kind of idea that every piece of art sells for $1 million is completely incorrect. In fact, most works sell for well under $50,000, and you can build great collections for under $20,000 a work. So I think one of the pitfalls of people discussing art is this sort of art is mysterious and it shouldn't be worth $1 million. In fact, they're great artists who've got terrific careers, both institutionally and with terrific galleries, who you can buy for $5,000-$10,000. And I think what defines artists who sell for a lot of money, a whole different set of parameters are at play that is almost like a different discussion. But going back to the drawings that your kids made, you know, I think the irony of making art as a practice is you sort of go to art school or you don't go to art school, you spend your entire life trying to make art as if you were a 5-year-old, to rid yourself of these sort of things that we learn as we grow up through the world, to to get back that instinctive energy, that creative kind of flow. And kids make amazing work. And everyone who's been in a school or worked with kids knows kids make great art. And I think like some of the most successful artists of the 20th century, like Jean Dubuffet and many others, even Picasso to a degree, have sort of somehow learned to channel that energy, that really childish energy, and do it in a way where you're doing it as an adult. So bringing in bigger themes, bringing in sexuality, death, partnership, breaking up with partners, loss, happiness, joy, you know, adult themes, and marrying them with this sort of energy that kids have to just sort of express their creative mediums without fear.
So when you there's a lot of criticism around the art world today that says that it's become less. I mean, for some people, it's still a collection of things that they love and art that they seek out. But you know, with especially in the economic climate that we find ourselves in, where it has become a place just to kind of park your money if you have a lot of it. Is that something you see in your industry?
Well, I think, you know, people tend to discuss the art world in very sort of black and white terms. Like there's this art world where things sell for millions and there's this art world where people don't have an opportunity. I think there is an art world of cultural production where people are engaged in conversation, dialogue with each other regionally, locally, and globally in really legitimate, interesting ways. I think that we're in a golden age of art production today. There's a lot of education, there's a lot of good materials, there's a lot of technology for art today, from 3D printing to huge advances in paint, acrylic paint and canvas and materials and shipping, transportation. And this has all created a sort of a production boon, in a sense, for artists to actually work in their media. And there are legitimate conversations around culture and art globally. However, the primary conversation that the media tends to adopt is the conversation of money and art. In other words, $1 million painting, price, price, price. Why is it worth so much? And this is one of the great tragedies of the art world in which we stand. And there certainly is this art world which most people know about and read about, which deals with how can something so trivial to make be worth so much money? And those headlines are things that most people who are not really in the art world think about and talk about. The conspiracy of the capital and art mixed together. I don't think it's a conspiracy. I think it's a very simple thing. We live in an environment where there is an excess of global liquidity. A huge excess, and this excess of global liquidity has been ongoing since 2000 when we had the tech crash, further pronounced by the 2008 crash where we reinflated the economy by increasing global liquidity, lowering interest rates, and then additionally using quantitative easing to basically, you know, not only turn on the host pipe, but turn on 10 host pipes. This excess global liquidity, I think, is expressing itself in many ways very negatively in zombie urbanism, where you have people buying massive apartments, buying houses, not living in them, using them to park their excess liquidity. Those people who have become beneficiaries of this excess of liquidity, and this has spilled over to the art market, where guys who've made $5 billion, $10 billion, $12 billion through privatizations in North Africa or Central Africa or Russia or the Middle East, you know, have to diversify their capital in assets.
So when they do that, when someone who says, "Oh well, I've bought 20 houses that no one's living in, and et cetera, and I'm going to buy some art now just to park it." How can
I don't even think there's a relationship where they're buying the art for the houses.
No. They're buying it to put to store the money somewhere.
They're buying
right?
it as stores of wealth, and they buy cars as stores of wealth. And art is a good mobile asset. So I think this.
How does that affect the rest of the market? Like how, you know, if
I don't think it has any effect on the rest of the market. I think this is a violent expression of capital. I think it's a violent expression of spending. I think it deals with people's egos at a very high level. They're sort of they're expressions that are actually irrelevant to the real conversation of culture and production that most people have. But they are able to receive the headline news because your average below reader can read in Vanity Fair, you know, this guy, Mr. So-and-so from Russia, bought this painting for $50 million, or this guy from Japan spent this. So it's very easy, palatable, easy to understand content for people to read. So this becomes the mainstream discussion of art, whereby it has absolutely no relationship whatsoever to the actual production of art in its emergent form, and in its, we're 40 years old, 30 years old, in our peer groups where it actually matters. So it's like it's somewhere up here in this isolated hole of a handful of, in relative terms, people sort of expressing, you know, what happens when you have excessive global liquidity. And, you know, I was just recently at Gagosian in London. They have an amazing, immaculate gallery in Mayfair. It's one of my favorite spaces in the world. And they put a remarkable show of Picasso, sort of bulls and cows. It was a beautiful show, curated, one of the most elegant shows. And in the back room, they had three works in probably a 2,000 square foot space by Picasso. Between those three works, it was about $120 million. One sculpture was 50, another was 40. And I'm thinking, they could never do that in L.A. They could never do it. You know, it only works in London, in a sense, because that is where the center of excessive global liquidity is sort of living. And I somehow think that we love Picasso, he's an important artist, etc. I think that art world deals with large amounts of capital, but is also largely irrelevant to what's actually really going on. And I think that...
So that's what, like the 0.001% of the art world, and the rest of it is...
I don't even think they're the art world. I was told recently that, you know, a very famous artist, I don't want to mention names, but like a gallery makes a lot of money because they sold a playground in the Middle East designed by this artist on the request of like a Middle Eastern princess. This is not the art market. These are sort of radical expressions of big expenditure, like $3 million for a playground by so-and-so. $3 million will buy you 300 artworks of very good young artists who are engaged institutionally, are in the global conversation of making art. And I'm very interested in sort of balancing this equation by providing a different viewpoint to actually support these structures that are under attack by... Not by anyone in particular, but imagine standing in a room and some guy comes with a giant fire hose and turns it on and points it at you. You're going to be blown off your feet. So the question is that is sort of strange with the war on culture. The capital that comes into culture is something that is good for it because it provides liquidity and money to grow galleries and do materials. But this money isn't going into culture. This money is sort of going into assets that are traded. I really want to take that fire hose and redirect it into young, emerging contemporary art production.
So, two questions. First, you mentioned technology, and it seems like the tech world, Silicon Valley, has disrupted everything that we touch on a daily basis, from banking to cars to, I mean, you just name it, politics, media. Has it disrupted the art world yet?
It hasn't directly touched the art world. It's disrupted it tangentially in the way that if you use Google Maps or Waze, you get to the museum quicker, in the way that if you do a search for an archer, you can find it quicker. It's disrupted it as it's, I think, in a good way, in that it's made art more accessible. It's provided platforms for the distribution of visual content very efficiently, whether it's social media, Instagram, Facebook. It's provided an ability to send 60 megabyte files by Gmail versus 10 years ago.
But there's no one that's like built a Amazon for art or something like that.
I don't think it's possible. I mean, I think the most interesting player in the space is Artsy, is Carter Cleveland, who I think has done an excellent job in aggregating content, getting a lot of people to use the platform. I think the user interface is good. But I don't believe the art world can be disrupted in the sense that Facebook can own everything or Google can own everything. That's one of the great things about art is it fragments, it dies and it grows and it kind of appears in a sense like lightning. It's very random. And I think the thing one needs to do is sort of build a membrane around the world so one can sort of track where the lightning occurs and then go with the lightning. I don't even believe people should try and kind of create one unifying entity for it, because it will homogenize culture in the same way that film production has been homogenized by in the film studio. It's under attack for different reasons.
What's under attack? Film studios or art?
Art. Cultural production is under attack for different reasons.
Well, so you say cultural production, and that's something that I find really fascinating. You know, when I look back at like Van Gogh and even Picasso and, you know, early famous artists, when you know, Eakins, people like that, when you walk through the New York museums, these were people that were partially famous. I mean, John Singer Sargent, of course, is the ultimate of this, but they were partially famous because they had a technique. They were skilled with a brush. They were able to create something that no one else could. And now I meet artists sometimes that are not even artists, that they hire people in China or somewhere else to create the thing that they
Let me just go back and address the previous question about first of all, the tech companies are not going to the opportunity in art is not scalable, so they're not that interested in it.
Yeah.
Tech is interested in scalable world domination ideas. You know, you can't really scale the art business in the same way that you can scale search or scale providing specific services. So that there's a barrier to entry in that they're going to put their resources somewhere else. On to your next question about skill. So skill is something that...
It doesn't seem like it's relevant
skill
anymore.
Skill is irrelevant.
Why is that?
Because, you know, there is a, you know, there are Cycladic sculptures made thousands of years ago. They're beautiful. Population of the Earth was 100 million. Very few people lived there. Very few people had money to subsist. So the fact that someone could actually be supported by a tribe or group of people to actually sit and make art and not hunt or not, you know, grow food is remarkable. And these objects are very valuable today. And they developed skills because there were very few people with skills. And as centuries grew on, there was very little money. 200 years ago, you know, paint, pigment, there were fewer people doing it. As technology of painting and acrylic paints and technology of actually the production items for art, the cost became low. There's a proliferation of skill because of the proliferation of people doing it. And I think the fundamental thing about art is the commodity of ideas, in my opinion, expressed with a unified aesthetic. And I think successful artists are able to express the commodity of ideas, sort of the artists sort of work with human capital in its intellectual sort of form, and create an aesthetic practice, whether it's painting, photography, performance, drawing, or all of them bound in one, which is unified to express a certain set of ideas. And skill is very respected still today. There are artists like Adrian Genny, extremely successful painter, highly skilled. And there are also artists whose physical skill is not as important because the strength of their conceptual ideas essentially balances that out. And the fetishization of skill is something that I think, you know, dies in the post-war period.
Yeah, but it dies in art. But, you know, I write books, right? If I came up with a really good idea for a book, I couldn't go and find someone and say, hey, let me pay you to write my book idea.
Of course you could.
Yeah, but it's not. But it's going to be. But I could do that. All right. But I couldn't go and say Nick Bilton on the cover of this book and go do interviews about this book that I wrote.
Of course you could, and people do. It's called ghostwriting. People do it all the time. That's absolutely incorrect. It happens every day.
Well, it's okay. So it's.
It might be hard to find a writer of your quality because you are a very good writer. But if I came to you today and I said, Nick, I want to write a book. I'm going to pay you $10 million. It's my name. There's a good chance that you'll do it.
$10
million? $10 million.
I'll do it.
Exactly. So.
But it seems it's a little different in the respect of yes, that exists where there are ghostwriters, right? But a ghostwriter still gets credit, and a ghostwriter is still someone who is skilled. You know,
not necessarily.
Well, I mean, look at like Kevin Hart's new book, and it's got the ghostwriter's name on the front, or you know, I mean, I know a few ghostwriters, and they still get some sort of credit in the thing. My point is that there are artists I know. It was one we mentioned earlier who we won't say, but who literally it's like a factory, like that it you know that is doing these things that are just bizarre, like a billboard with a that has a photo of clouds on it. They never once touched a single moment of it, but yet it sits in a museum somewhere.
Can I mention the artist's name?
Sure.
So, I mean, the artist we're discussing is Alex Israel. And, you know, this conversation is, and I was telling your wife that there's good art, there's bad art. It's still art. Just like Duchamp always says, there's a good emotion and a bad emotion. It's still an emotion. There are many artists who are good artists, and I think Alex Israel is a good artist. I think he's probably a very good artist. I am not partial to his work. It doesn't mean it's bad. And I'm more partial, and you can be partial to a bad artist's work because it speaks to you. There's so many different forms of creation and so many different mechanisms that you really have to sort of be very open today in sort of analyzing what's going on. And the fetishization of one guy actually making the marks has no relevance. Now, it's relevant if the guy is a painter. I work with a guy named Zachary Armstrong. Zachary is a traditional painter in the likes of Marc Grosjean, Lucian Freud, Francis Bacon. Every mark he makes is his own mark. It would be unthinkable for him to have someone else making the marks. But that is because he is, in a sense, very traditionally a painter. That is his practice. Alex Israel is a conceptual artist whose practice is different. So I think, you know, I think practice is very important in defining what people do, and skill is really something when you can buy skill, you know, like if you look at a painting by Alex Israel, he could hire 500 different people to paint that palm tree. It's irrelevant. It's got nothing to do with the style of painting the palm tree. It's not about mark making or brush stroking. It really is just about the image and the form of the image. Whereas someone like Zachary Armstrong, it really is about mark making. It's about what's happening on the canvas. It's about the artist's hand, the expression of the artist's hand. And I think through the ages, we've had very different ideas of what an artist is. You mentioned, you know, the old
Sargent
and the old artist. And if you watch the movies, we have these very romantic pictures of what those artists were, how they, Rembrandt, and they performed very, our idea and our image of them is very specific. If we go to the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, and then we think about how do we conceptualize an artist from the 60s, we have a specific idea what a 60s artist looked like. It's usually like Andy Warhol, like a party animal full of, surrounded by celebrities. Or we go to the 80s, and we have these sort of cheesy ideas of artists in like lofts in Soho painting with loud music in the background, like played by Nick Nolte. And so like society, sort of the large swaths of society have this idea of what they want an artist's image to be. And usually those are sort of false ideas. They're like ideas that the artist occupies a position where he has to have a moral function that's very specific.
So what is society's version of what an artist is today in 2017?
It's a good question. You know, I think, are we speaking like mass market, broadly speaking?
No, so let's just fast forward 10 years and you look back and you were having this conversation and you said, you know, in the 80s it was this, in the 90s it was that.
What is it today? I mean, today it's probably like an Instagram happy street artist, you know, who's like, you know, running around tagging walls. It's like, you know, it's not very profound.
Well, that was my next question. Is, you know, getting back to this technology question, is you and I both take photos, love our Leicas. I've been doing it for years. I never made a vocation out of it because it just was something that I did on the side as for fun. But I tremendously admire photographers, and I have some friends who are photographers who have a hard time making a living now because of the Instagram world we live in, where technology has replaced their skill largely. And they no longer are hired by, you know, Land Rover to do a photo shoot, because Land Rover goes along to some influential Instagram person and says, hey, I'll give you $10,000 or whatever it is to take over my account for the day and go take a really bad photo of you looking down your feet in front of a Land Rover or something like that. Are these things, social media, Instagram, VCRO, all those apps and things like that, are they affecting, I don't know if you, how much you're involved in the photography world, but the art world in general?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's sort of a global mass dumbing down of culture. There is a watering down of everything, from the modeling industry, where you see, you know, models who couldn't get arrested 15 years ago, you know, on the cover of American Vogue, to you see it in every industry. You see it in the art business, where artists like Brainwash and Banksy, you know, are like known by everyone, and the work is pretty awful. It's like, you know, art for teenagers, basically. And in the art world, you see the same thing, but you also see the ability of very good artists being able to find networks and market themselves, because there are so many people online that there's a huge mass of zombie dumb people, but there's also an aggregation of elites and people who have been excluded from the elite circle globally, who are sort of stitching together their own networks. So you have this sort of very complex environment. And I think, you know, talking about elitism, which is something that is interesting, I don't think it's a problem of there's too much elitism. I think that the elites have lost the idea that they have a responsibility to lead culture, and they have shunned many of the more populist mechanisms and approaches to empower culture to really compete against this sort of brainless horde of cultural dumbing down. So they've neglected to use the same weapons. And the gallery system and the institutional system and the art system that I'm involved in was very late to the game in using social media, and uses it in a very sort of isolating way. In fact, very few of the gallery owners have their own personal Instagrams. They sort of, it's the gallery speaking to you. It's the institution speaking to you.
Not the people.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that is so important is what the message we are getting from social media and Instagram, and what you're talking about, is these brands want to speak directly to people. They want to communicate with people's lives. They want to know what people's lives look like. And in my community, in my art world, I think that would be really interesting if we actually knew what were David Zwirner's political views. What did Ivan Wirth like for breakfast? What are the positions? But they're sort of isolated sort of entities that are separated by this wall of high culture. And I think in order to compete and bring great elite culture, great fine art into the larger world, where we can displace the crap that is being produced and marketed and bought, and really educate people so they can have a much more meaningful conversation with art, we really need to use the same weapons as they use. And this is something that I would like to see more of.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
Let me ask you a question. When was the last time you spontaneously sent someone flowers, just out of the blue? My guess is it's been a long time. But the other day someone did this for us, and it was such a lovely surprise. Just out of the blue, a dozen white roses showed up at our house. They came from proflowers.com, and I decided I was going to do the same thing afterwards, and I sent a friend flowers just because. Proflowers is so simple to use, and they have special flowers for all different kinds of occasions for all different kinds of people. They can do birthdays, congratulations, sympathy, or my personal favorite, the just because section. They have gourmet flowers where you can buy someone a bouquet of chocolate-covered strawberries or cupcakes. If anyone listening wants to send me some of those, please don't hesitate. You can send someone plants like bonsai trees or succulents, and they ship everything in these perfect little containers to ensure the flowers stay fresh on the trip and for 7 days afterwards. ProFlowers wants to help you surprise someone for no reason at all. And to do that, they're offering listeners of Inside the Hive 20% off any of their unique summer rose bouquets or any other bouquets of $29 or more. ProFlowers also gives you all the bloom for your buck. Get it? All the bloom for your buck? Okay, bad joke. Anyway, to get the 20% off the summer roses or any of their bouquets over $29, all you need to do is go to proflowers.com and use my code HIVE at checkout. That's H-I-V-E. That's proflowers.com and use HIVE at checkout. H-I-V-E. And if you're wondering why you should buy someone flowers, you should just do it because. So you you sell art to people of all economic stripes. I'm sure people that make a small amount, nominal amount of money, medium amount of money, and people that make a tremendous amount of money, billionaires and so on. And I've heard from folks that do what you do that that people in Silicon Valley that are worth billions have absolutely no sense or interest in art whatsoever.
I think that's,
is that the case that you've come across?
I think largely speaking, it's true. I remember sitting next to a very well-known venture capitalist a couple of years ago at dinner, and I asked him to explain this to me. And he said, well, we're a culture of makers and doers, not thinkers. And I love philosophy, and I think philosophy is very important. I think philosophy is sort of the centerpiece of human existence, very important in giving us a guidepost into which direction to walk. I think this is one of the structural weaknesses of the tech world, profound weaknesses, possibly very dangerous weaknesses when we look down 100 years, 200 years, is where is the philosophical benchmark that, that Western civilization has really struggled with over centuries? And I also think that the mechanisms of the art world are not constructed in a way that they reach out to new audiences that are different. So one of the things that I experienced with some of my, I do have clients who are in the tech world, and one of the things they fear more than anything is wealth porn. There is a culture where philanthropy is something that is very important.
You're talking about the fact that they live in a what looks like an inexpensive house, but there's 13 layers underneath with bowling alleys and swimming pools.
Exactly. Yeah. So
but
so,
the perception is that they...
The perception is that, yeah. So yeah. Wealth porn is something... So I think the art world constructed classically is really about wealth porn. And if you look at the auctions and, you know, Miyazawa goes to auction and he's buys a $55 million basket and he breaks the record and buys a $110 million basket and he appears with Len Blavatnik at Leonardo DiCaprio's auction and they spend a lot of money and the whole world sees it and they see these sort of almost violent expressions of capital expenditure. There's almost a violence to them. It's very strange. You can actually think of them as being, they're like Vikings macheting people on a battlefield, and they're spending money and the world's watching and they're getting the headlines. It's the opposite in Silicon Valley. And the art world is very good at creating an environment for these guys to spend like that in a very visible way, and not very good at understanding. It is good at selling art discreetly for reasons that are different. Whether you've got trusts and you have money, whatever the reason, but it's not very good at talking to these guys in Silicon Valley. And I've made a great effort. I go up there a lot.
Does Mark Zuckerberg buy artwork?
I don't know. He hasn't bought artwork from me. I would expect, from what I know, very little, and it would be great for him to buy artwork. Mark, if you happen to be listening, my number's public.
But to go back to the philosophy aspect of Silicon Valley, I mean, this has been one of my problems with the tech community and the tech world is that it's like they can't see past their own nose. You know, that statement of the fact that we are makers and not thinkers is true and sad in many respects, because it means that they are unaware of the implications of their creations, but then in the same respect, unaware of the fact that, you know, look, one of the things about, you say what you want about hedge fund guys and Wall Street, but first of all, they own it. you know, we're here to make money and that's it. Here's my private jet. Here's my massive art collection. And they also, as a result of not being afraid of this wealth porn, is there's a trickle down that develops, as in, which leads to artists and so on and so forth. And in Silicon Valley, you know, it's...
I'm not sure if I agree with that. I think many of the hedge fund guys have really homogenized cultural consumption to a degree where it's completely uninteresting. I think the tech guys are the holy grail of the art world because they don't care about homogenization. They're actually, underneath, profoundly interested in doing things that are dislocated. If the tech crowd can be cracked to collect, in my opinion, it's...
But they haven't collected yet.
They've started. Incrementally, they've started. It's just different. They're just not doing it at the same pace. And I think it's... I think, you know, a lot of the guys are very busy building businesses. They can get killed by competitors any second. And people are distracted. The art world has this expectation that you become a collector and your raison d'etre for living and being is to appear at the art fair at the VIP opening to compete for a piece from a gallery. And I think that the art world can build a different structure to reach these guys. It's just a different format of communication. It's not the same thing. I think there would be a lot of interest. It just has to be developed. And there are many guys who are slowly dipping their toe in. And I think I think they really need to be sort of... There are problems with the tech world. Yes, at scale, the amount of capital that has been accumulated there is really irrelevant as far as expenditures in art. But I think it's very important not to alienate this group of people. It's very important to sort of encourage them to engage and use whatever mechanisms you can to make them comfortable. Many of them love Burning Man. They think Burning Man is the center of global cultural production, the most important thing in the world. I don't think so, but God bless them. It's great. It's a beginning. You know, collecting art is a process. It's like you go to kindergarten, you go to high school, you go to college, you get a PhD, you get a master's. Any engagement in culture is the beginning of a conversation from which to learn as a platform. And yes, are there problems? Is Burning Man, you know, culturally that relevant? No, I don't think so. I might be wrong, but you know, it's. I think it's very important to allow the tech world and to establish mechanisms and footholds for them to come into the art world in their way, in the way that they feel comfortable. And what I've done in my business is I've sort of said I'm a very flexible structure. You and your wife hopefully will become clients of mine. On a very moderate
only if
scale.
Only if I do that book for $10 million.
Only if you do the book for $10 million. But not necessarily. We can figure something out. But I think it's very important for dealers and art dealers and distributors of cultural production to really make the suit to fit the man instead of like this off-the-rack suit that you kind of like, you go and you're if you're this guy, you can get into the club. You've got to really, and that effort is a very different process to walking to a gallery and the gallery says, this is not available, this is for an institution, this is for this fancy collector who's been collecting for 30 years and they don't bother to come out. You really have to be, you have to be on the ground, you've got to be out there, you've got to be very humble, you've got to realize that you actually have no power or impact and whatever you know or your knowledge is not relevant to these people. The key is to sort of recruit in a religious sense someone. It's a religious sort of thing. It's like, do you have meaning in your life? Do you want to do something interesting? It's a process. It's a conversion in a sense.
Is art today, especially when you look at some of the people that you represent that are up and coming, is it a gamble when you buy?
I mean, it's only a gamble if you buy, if you expect to make money. You know, if your expectation is I'm going to spend $5,000 so I can make 20, then it's a gamble. But when you fly business class to London, you spend $4,000, is it your expectation to receive $20,000 back for flying business class? No. So there's this...
You've used that sales pitch before, haven't you?
I have. But there's this ridiculous assumption that every time you spend money on art, it decorates your goddamn wall. You have stuff framed here that... You framed this. Happiness is catching. We get it from one another. This beautiful little tapestry I'm looking at.
My mom actually made that.
And it's framed. This frame costs money. Did you, so this actually cost money, maybe not a little. Did you ever think about getting a return on that cost?
No.
No. And so some things you will get a return because they'll become rare and valuable over time. But I think this like easy, it's very easy for people to understand, oh, you're buying this thing that has no value. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't walk. It doesn't sing. The only thing it really does is decorate your wall. It should be worth more money after I buy it. But most people buy stuff and decorate their walls for little money and never think it's going to return. They go to Z Gallery and buy something for $300. They don't think they're going to make money on it. It has a decorative function. So I think the art world has alienated people because it says, oh, it's decorative, meaning it's bad. And I think the art world has created this trap for themselves where they've sort of said, if it's decorative, it's bad. And decoration is associated with feminine and ethnic. So there's a whole subtext here.
What do you mean by feminine and ethnic?
Feminine art is decorative. Ethnic art is decorative. So there's this whole subtext construct here of sort of marginalizing the female and the ethnic by calling it decorative. In the art world, to say an artist is decorative is like one of the grave insults. I mean, I got into I was interviewed by the New York Times about Joseph Albers, and it was one of the great artists of the 20th century. And I said, Joseph Albers is a decorative artist. He makes good decorative work. He's a very good artist as well. He's a conceptual artist. And Zwirner's representative, this guy David, I forget his name, but he said it's not decorative. Joseph Albers is serious. He's not a decorative artist. So there's this like antagonism, and I think we got to break this wall down and say, you know what, it's okay. You like it. It's decorative. You don't have to understand the conceptual narrative. We'll teach that later. We'll teach you 1 + 1 = 2 today. We'll do algebra next week, and in 5 years, we'll teach you some calculus. So it's a process. You don't have to like get it immediately.
So coming to a close here, one of the things that usually happens in fascist political climates is the new forms of art are created, and creativity kind of has this resurgence
in fascist environments.
Well, in environments where there are politicians a la like Donald Trump.
In fascist environments, yeah. Culture is stamped out. In fascist environments, the Soviets come and rip the building facades off the buildings. In environments where there are elements of fascism and different energies, but where you still have freedom to express yourself and capital to invest, art prospers. Okay. But in true fascist environments...
Okay, so in the instance that we are in today,
yeah.
Have you seen art prospering in new ways under Trump?
I don't think Trump as a counterbalance to art is that interesting.
But it's something that a lot of people have spoken about, right?
Yeah, it's expected. The artist goes, Donald Trump's a bad guy. Look at this painting. It's like a trope. It's like, okay, artists against Donald Trump is bullshit. The art that really makes a difference is the art that doesn't need to discuss Donald Trump. It's the art when you look at it and it takes you to a different place. It encourages a sense of balance and power and beauty that is above Donald Trump and his stupid tirades. And I think like there are artists who have made careers out of making political work, and they're very good. Andrea Bowers is a local artist here, I think one of the best artists working. Her entire career has been about politics. It's been about marginalization during the Obama era, during the Trump era, during every era. So her practice is whatever is going on, that's what her practice is about, because there will always be marginalization. There will always be fascism, no matter who's in power. But I think for artists who are like suddenly like, oh, great, Trump is this trope that we can make art and be relevant against, very manipulative, bad. Art is art. Art flourishes if it achieves its fundamental goal, and that is the goal of the artist, which is disciplined, which is constrained, which is authentic, and which is true to the entire practice of the artist over a long period of time. So do I think Donald Trump is going to make good art prosper? No, I don't think Donald Trump is going to make anything good prosper, unfortunately.
Which was a different tune than you were singing a few months ago, but we'll...
No, that's not true. I'm a very practical guy.
Oh, but come on, when I saw you at a coffee shop right after the election and you were like, I think it's going to be great.
I was hoping it's going to be great. He won. I voted for Hillary Clinton. He won. But, you know, good things come out of it. We got rid of the entire apparatus of the Clintons, 30,000 people, gone. And by the time Trump is gone and torn apart in 1,000 pieces, the Republican Party will be decimated. And it's great. So we can sort of construct a new environment. And we sorely need a new environment. You know, the Obama administration, the Clinton administration, Bill Clinton put more African Americans in prison than anyone in history.
Yep.
Created it. So, I mean, they're all essentially the same people with different front ends. I like Barack Obama very much. You know, I think he was, I like him personally. I think he was an amazing, splendid individual and sorely missed. But, you know, when a guy gets voted president, you give him a chance, you watch, you see the data. And I do this with art as well. I watch, I see the data. You know, I don't like Alex Israel's work. He's a good artist. I can say that, and I can say that on Vanity Fair in a podcast. You know, I think you have to look at the data. You have to analyze things fairly. You've got to have a neutral standpoint. Otherwise, you have sort of confirmation bias, which is a very, very dangerous thing as a journalist, as an art dealer, as anyone. And, you know, I think it's, you know, tragic where we are in the world, and, you know, it will resolve itself probably, you know, in a nice violent way, but you know,
this a nice violent way.
This is the nature of the world.
All right. So one of the questions I ask a lot of people on this podcast is, if you could go back in time and give your younger self some advice, what would it be? So that's one. I'm asking you, the art dealer who once supported Trump for 5 minutes.
Don't be so judgmental.
Wait, what is it? What is it?
Don't be so judgmental.
Don't be so. So in earlier days you were, or you still are, or?
No, I think, I mean, judgmental in that just be, collect more data before you, collect more information before you judge, collect more data, you know, collect, watch, listen more before you conclude.
And that applies to both art and life.
And life, absolutely, yeah. Okay.
Well, thank you so much. What's your website again, just so we know?
Simcoe's Club. Do I have to pay? Do you take credit cards?
We take credit cards, okay, good. Cash, Bitcoin, you name it.
How much is a Simcoe's Club on this podcast?
Thank you so much, Stefan, for taking the time to chat.
Bye, guys.
Thank you to my guest, Stefan Simkiewicz. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. You can find these on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work. And thanks, of course, to my sponsor, ProFlowers. Please support them the same way you support this podcast. I'll see you next week.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
From PRX.